he put it, he discharged the original trade unions and their leaders. In actuality, they were destroyed and murdered. We have, of course, discharged the functions of the trade union, but at the same time we have added the following: strength through joy, leisure time, and recreation to a very large extent, generous health projects with plant physicians and so forth, then also a vast specialized educational program, a program for increasing overall efficiency with model plants, general recommendations to be followed in factories in which millions of workmen participated, housing projects on a vast scale, and a public education program for millions of people. I endeavored to make the fate of both the German workmen as well as the workmen of foreign origin as pleasant as possible. I regret very much that this ideal organization will not be introduced in other countries for the benefit of their people. Ley received his indictment in October 1945, and somehow it came as a shock. He didn't mind being treated as an enemy, but was humiliated to be considered a criminal. Although he had been imprisoned since May and repeatedly interrogated, he apparently denied the implications of the interrogations until he was formally indicted. When he was offered a list of attorneys who might represent him before the tribunal, he replied, "If at all possible, I would like to have a Jewish person as my defense counsel." He would be dead in 2 weeks, and not at the hands of the tribunal. On October 25, 1945, he rigged a noose out of strips of towels and stuffed his mouth with his underpants to muffle any sounds of moaning. He then patiently tied the other end of the strip of towels to a sink pipe, sat down on the toilet, leaned forward, and strangled himself. The guard realized too late that Ley was not just sitting on the toilet seat. Warden Andrus commented later, "What a way to die. Strangled with his own loincloth, on his own dung heap." Andrus's sardonic comment aside, this was not a promising beginning of the trial, and Andrus knew it. He increased the number of guards and announced that his jail was now suicide-proof. The Greeks have a word for that. Hubris. Ley left multiple suicide notes. In one, he went out of his way to say that he was not mistreated in prison. In another, he expressed remorse and guilt for his activities during the war. "I can't stand the shame anymore. I have been one of the responsible men. I was with Hitler in the good days, during the fulfillment of our plans and hopes, and I want to be with him in the black days. God led me in whatever I did. We have forsaken God, and therefore we were forsaken by God. Anti-Semitism distorted our outlook, and we made grave errors. It is hard to admit mistakes, but the whole existence of our people is in question. We Nazis must have the courage to rid ourselves of anti-Semitism. We have to declare to the youth that it was a mistake." The other prisoners could not have cared less about the news of Ley's suicide. Prison physician René H. Euclid reported to General Donovan that Ley's fellow prisoners regarded him as a fantastic dreamer with his dreams as confused as his talks, and felt that his death should have occurred 15 years sooner. Reich Economics Minister Hjalmar Schacht added caustically that he only regretted the delay of the incident. Goering was thoroughly disgusted, and Stryker was ashamed to be locked up with such a weakling. Hitler Youth leader Baldur von Schirach thought that Ley's death was cowardly, as well as unfair to the rest of them in that Ley would no longer be able to help with their defense. Empathy for this group was in short supply, but there was certainly an abundance of nastiness. This paucity of empathy would be a key point in the emerging arguments concerning psychopathology in the Nazi leaders. Kelly's and Gilbert's assessment. Given Gilbert's arrival on October 23rd and Ley's suicide just 2 days later, Gilbert made few observations of Ley. Kelly, however, knew Ley from his ashcan days, as well as Ley's earlier days in Nuremberg. He had observed Ley daily for 6 weeks and wrote his summary of Ley to the commanding officer of the Internal Security Detachment at Nuremberg just days before Ley killed himself. Reading Kelly's notes, one recognizes the familiar cadence of a mental status examination. Normal psychomotor reactions and normal attitudes and behavior. Mood is normal, but affect is extremely labile. Lei is easily excited and demonstrates marked emotional instability. Content is normal, although euphoric trends are present. Sensorum is intact. Insight is good and judgment fair. Rorschach examination reveals emotional instability and evidence of frontal lobe damage, manifested by color and shading responses, confused form, and inadequate construction of responses. He is one of the most potentially suicidal prisoners due to his extreme instability, secondary to his old head injury. Lei is competent. Commenting on Lei's Rorschach response, Kelly noted, "The overall picture of Robert Lei's Rorschach record is definitely that of an individual suffering from damage to his frontal lobes." Elsewhere, Kelly reported that Lei's inhibitory centers had ceased to function. The details of the Rorschach responses are arresting. Lei was easily derailed. Here is Kelly's verbatim description. In card 4, he saw a funny bear, fur spread out, and in the inquiry he stated, "You can see the head and teeth with terrific legs. It has shadows and peculiar arms. It is alive and represents Bolshevism overrunning Europe." Once started on this point, there was a short intermission until we could get Dr. Lei off the subject of Bolshevism and back to the subject of Rorschach cards. Kelly was struck most of all by Lei's emotional instability, which he attributed to frontal lobe damage. Lei had grandiose dreams of immigrating to the United States to solve America's labor difficulties. In the month before he killed himself, Lei wrote to Sir Henry Ford, asking for a job, reasoning that since both he and Ford were in the automobile business and both were anti-Semites, they would be natural partners. Regarding Lei's suicide, Kelly wrote sardonically in 1946, "Since Lei kindly made his brain available for post-mortem examination, we were presented with a rare chance to verify our clinical and Rorschach findings." Lei's brain. Lei's death presented an opportunity to literally get one's hands on a Nazi leader's brain. At least, that is the way the popular press portrayed it. Indeed, his brain was the only Nuremberg brain available for scrutiny. The brain was removed from Lei's body a few hours after his suicide and was shipped to the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Washington, D.C. Eminent neuropathologist Webb Haymaker examined the brain. His initial report, recorded in pencil on yellow-lined paper, noted brain atrophy, suggested by widened folds, sulci, on the brain's surface, and thickened membranes, meninges, on the brain's surface, which could have resulted from a long-ago head injury. He commented, "We are dealing with a case of confirmed degenerative atrophy of the frontal lobes. The appearance is that of a long-standing degeneration, or chronic encephalopathy, the etiology of which is unknown." Haymaker explained that the frontal lobes were the seat of our inhibitions, the real control center that keeps most people from committing acts of violence. It's this part that enables us to have sympathy with our fellow man. Microscopic examination of Lei's brain revealed chronic encephalopathy of sufficient duration and degree to have impaired Dr. Lei's mental and emotional faculty, and could well account for his alleged aberrations in conduct and feelings. When this news got out, the Sarasota Herald-Tribune quoted Major General Turk, Surgeon General of the Army, as saying that the changes were sufficient to account for the unusual behavior of Lei. Not to be outdone, Life magazine ran a story showing Haymaker dissecting Lei's brain. The AP headline from the Washington Times-Herald stated simply, "Lei's brain was warped." The Washington Post was more restrained. Nazi Lei's brain found diseased. Lei's left cerebral hemisphere demonstrates slight frontotemporal atrophy with widened sulci or folds. There is no evidence of contusion, but the membrane that surrounds the brain is fibrotic and thickened. Severe alcoholism with malnutrition typically alters the mammillary bodies in the brain. Haymaker would certainly have looked for this, and we must infer that there was no abnormality, given his silence on the matter. Kelly felt that Lei's frontal lobe damage probably resulted from the World War I head injury, noting that Lei had been unconscious for several hours afterward. In addition, Lay had sustained a second head injury in an automobile accident in 1930. Following yet another extended period of unconsciousness, the car accident worsened his stammer and also left him with severe tinnitus. Kelly commented, "To overcome his stammer, he turned to liquor. He found that if he drank a lot, the impediment became less noticeable." The neuropathologists observing bilateral frontal lobe changes disagreed with Kelly's assessment that the frontal lobe changes reflected traumatic injury. Instead, they were inclined to attribute the encephalopathy to alcohol abuse. There is an important postscript to the story on Lay's brain. It turns out that Haymaker asked a colleague for a second opinion on the neuropathology. Dr. Nathan Malamud of the Langley Porter Neuropsychiatric Institute in San Francisco examined the tissue with Nissl and Van Giessen stains and wrote back on March 31, 1947, "As I warned you beforehand, I am not impressed with any definite pathology in this case, at least such as would lead one to suspect a clinical organic condition. The findings are difficult to evaluate because of post-mortem or fixation artifact, but if real, the changes are not too significant. The histological picture is that of a chronic diffuse encephalopathy of non-specific type, even if one allows for artifacts of fixation and paraffin embedding." The microscopic examination supports Malamud's interpretation. "It is an unremarkable slide that shows some fixation artifact, but no evidence of syphilis, no microglial hyperplasia, perivascular plasma cell cuffing, or neuronal dropout, or evidence of Alzheimer's disease, no plaques or tangles, or of Pick's disease, no intraneuronal inclusion bodies. If there was malice here, it was not discernible on the slide." With Malamud's second opinion in hand, Haymaker wrote to Kelly on December 15, 1947, "I have gone over the case very carefully and found changes, but they were of a lesser scope than we had at first believed. Personally, I think maybe we had better let the whole thing lie buried, as the degree of change could be subject to a difference of opinion." As is typical with press reports about medical discoveries, no effort was made to correct the historical record. As far as readers of the Associated Press were concerned, Robert Lay's behavior had been definitively traced to his bad brain. Bad brain or not, Lay was not a monster in the Frankenstein sense. Indeed, he was one of the few Nuremberg defendants to express remorse over his actions. A perspective from the 21st century. Of all the Nazi war criminals, Lay would definitely have been evaluated differently in the 21st century. After all, his neuropsychiatric presentation posed many questions. He suffered from two major head injuries and a prolonged loss of consciousness, and for a while he had total aphasia. For the rest of his life, he was described as having a profound stammer, but one wonders in retrospect if this was an expressive aphasia. The accidents left him with impulsivity and erratic behavior, no doubt aggravated by his legendary alcoholism. Today we would document his impulsivity and map its extent with psychological testing, but we wouldn't stop there because memory and judgment would also have to be assessed. Most assuredly, we would obtain neural imaging to map the extent of his brain injury. These evaluations would be absolutely routine. If we had a brain biopsy, we would perform newer straining techniques, immunohistochemistry. Had Lay come to trial, all of these assessments would be sitting on his lawyer's desk, and the court would have to struggle to weigh their relevance. Chapter 6. Defendant Hermann Göring, Amiable Psychopath. Göring is a supreme egotist and a consummate liar, but a charming rascal. Thomas Dodd, Nuremberg Prosecutor, March 18, 1946. "They don't have to show films and read documents to prove that we rearmed for war. Of course we rearmed. Why, I rearmed Germany until we bristled. I'm only sorry we didn't rearm still more. Of course I considered your treaties. So much toilet paper. Of course I wanted to make Germany great. If it could be done peacefully, all well and good. If not, that was fine too." Hermann Göring to Gustav Gilbert, December 11, 1945. interrogating Goering. Goering and Ley were strikingly different. If Ley regarded his indictment as a devastating humiliation, Goering had contempt for the whole trial and looked forward to going down fighting. Even their suicides were different. Ley's was driven by guilt and remorse. Goering's was motivated by his desire to humiliate the Allies and die a martyr's death. In his prime, Hermann Goering was president of the Reichstag, founder of the Gestapo, commander-in-chief of the Luftwaffe, and creator of the first concentration camps. He cultivated a jovial persona, but behind that was a three-dimensional complexity that was at once attractive and repellent. Goering was larger than life, a dissolute man with a taste for luxury and larceny. Compared to others in the Nazi hierarchy, he was personable and expansive, eccentric and amusing. Seeing himself as a latter-day Caesar, Goering loved dressing up in costumes, wearing expensive brooches, and giving extraordinary parties at his mansion, Carenhall, where he kept pet lions and had a miniature airplane that could drop bombs on his model railroad. After regaling his guests with this unusual entertainment, he would escort them into another room to watch cowboy and Indian movies, which he adored. Although Goering was massively corrupt and plundered art from everywhere, he had a soft spot for animals and was proud to be chief forester of Germany, promulgating rules to ensure that animals were treated humanely. But there was also that other side of Goering. After enacting anti-vivisection laws in Prussia, he threatened that anyone who violated those laws would face severe penalties and risked being thrown in a concentration camp. Retribution always prowled behind his facade of caring. For Goering, racism and anti-Semitism were secondary concerns. When asked why he had appointed as his deputy Field Marshal Erhard Milch, who had some Jewish ancestry, Goering replied, "In Germany, a Jew is whoever I say is a Jew." Years later, he arranged for the rescue and emigration of two Jewish sisters who had saved his life in 1923 when he was badly wounded in the Munich Putsch. Goering thus represented an interesting mix of brutality and tenderness. Writing his wife from prison, "To see your beloved handwriting, to know that your dear hands have rested on this very paper, sometimes I think my heart will break with love and longing for you. That would be a beautiful death. My dear wife, I am so sincerely thankful to you for all the happiness that you always gave me, for your love and for everything. I can tell you endlessly what you and Edda, his daughter, mean to me and how my thoughts keep centering on you. I hold you in passionate embrace and kiss your dear sweet face." These tender feelings, however, did not extend beyond family and animals. He did, after all, convene the 1C conference, which designed the final solution. In interrogations, Goering, aka the Fat Man, was hard to pin down. Intelligence officer Dolebois captured Goering's complexity. "He's been described as everything from the devil incarnate to a silly fat eunuch. He was an able, shrewd manager, brilliant and brave, ruthless and grasping. At times he turned on his charm and it was almost a pleasure to be with him. At other times he was simply a pain in the ass. But every hour spent with him was interesting." Many of our richest sources about Goering are stored in the National Archives in College Park, Maryland. I was working there one morning in a large room filled with humming and whirling microfilm machines and their quiet scholarly acolytes. I chanced upon a cache of transcripts containing Goering's interrogations, as well as a surprising interrogation of Goering's younger brother Albert. I had never even heard of Albert, but his story is remarkable. He had opposed the Nazi Party and went out of his way to rescue Jews, in one case joining Jewish women who were forced to their knees to scrub the streets with acid. Hermann always bailed him out when he got into trouble with the authorities. On September 25, 1946, Albert was interrogated. Question: "What did your brother say when you told him about the terrible things that were being done to the Jews?" Answer: "Well, his reaction was always that these things were exaggerated, because he had exact reports on them. He said for me not to mix into affairs of state and affairs of history, because I had no political knowledge whatever. His very words, You are a political idiot. Hermann always called me the black sheep of the family for rescuing Jews and opposing the Nazi Party. Goering was incensed by the premise of the Nuremberg trial and regarded the Allies as hypocrites, pointing out that the British had invented concentration camps in the Boer War. The Russians had massacred Polish officers in Katyn Forest and millions of their own people, and the Americans had slaughtered American Indians. When Goering heard that the Americans had dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima, he commented, "Aha, now who are the war criminals?" Colonel John Ammann interrogated Goering extensively, and the transcript provides an unusual glimpse of Goering's view of personal responsibility. On September 6, 1945, Ammann asked Goering about the bombing of Rotterdam. Question: did you personally order the bombing of Rotterdam? Answer: yes, but I did not personally order the bombing of Rotterdam, but of the place where the fighting took place. We had dropped parachutists there, and they were surrounded and they were fighting there. That was why the place was bombed. I wish to say the entire bombardment of Rotterdam was done by 36 planes, and if the people of Rotterdam hadn't been such cowards, they could have extinguished the fires. Nobody from the people or fire brigades from Rotterdam made any attempt to extinguish the flames, and that is why the fire spread so much and demolished all those houses, which were old. The fire then spread throughout the houses and blocks, and the situation got worse. And even after the fight was over, nobody attempted to extinguish it. The whole bombing only lasted 5 minutes. This interchange is arresting for a number of reasons. Goering had a phenomenal memory for details. Even though the bombing had occurred 5 years earlier, he remembered every detail of the bombing sites and pointed them out to Ammann on a large, detailed map of Rotterdam. Goering's repeated efforts to shift blame are particularly striking. He didn't order the bombing of Rotterdam, but only the place where the fighting took place, that is, Rotterdam. Further, only 36 planes had bombed the city, and at that, the bombing was very brief. Moreover, the buildings were old fire traps, and it was the people of Rotterdam's fault that the place burned down, because they were cowards and didn't try hard enough to put out the fire. Ammann's efforts to trap Goering were inevitable flops. Goering parried each leading question with a rebuttal that had its own edge to it. On September 7, 1945, Ammann hoped to snare Goering into admitting that he had ordered reprisals. Question: don't you remember giving out a statement to the effect that if the British killed any of your aviators, that you were going to kill 10 for every one that the British killed? Answer:
no, I never said that.
Question: that is what the documents show. Answer:
I would like to see the documents.
Question: I know you would, and maybe you will eventually, but I am trying to see if you don't remember about it first. Answer:
does that mean that this document contains an order which I gave to that effect in writing?
Question: I am not answering the questions. You are answering the questions. Answer:
well, the colonel has the documents to ask me from, and I have nothing to rely on but my recollection.
Goering could be surprisingly candid. When questioned about the Nazis' use of slave labor, he stated, "They served to help in the economic war. We used this labor for security reasons, so they could not be active in their own country and work against us." In an interview with Leon Goldenson, the psychiatrist who succeeded Kelly, Goering commented on the proceedings. "Frankly, it is my intention to make this trial a mockery. I feel that a foreign country has no right to try the government of a sovereign state." Goering went on to criticize the structure of the trial and even the tribunal's selection of defendants. "I have desisted from making any critical remarks about my co-defendants. Yet they are a mixed-up, unrepresentative group. Some of them are so unimportant I have never even heard of them." Referring to Hans Fritsch, Walter Funk, and Wilhelm Keitel, whom he viewed as small fish compared to himself. In one wide-ranging interview, Goering discussed genocide, guilt, good and evil. "Even if one has no compunction about exterminating a race, common sense dictates that in our civilization this is barbaric and would be subject to so much criticism from abroad and within that it would be condemned as the greatest criminal act in history. Understand that I am not a moralist, although I have my chivalric code.
If I really felt that the killing of Jews meant winning the war, I would not be too bothered by it. But it was meaningless, and did nobody any good whatever except to give Germany a bad name. I don't believe in the Bible or in a lot of things which religious people think. But I revere women, and I think it unsportsmanlike to kill children. That is the main thing that bothers me about the extermination of the Jews. For myself, I feel quite free of responsibility for the mass murders. I heard rumors of mass killings of Jews, but I could do nothing about it, and I knew that it was useless to investigate these rumors and to find out about them accurately. But I was busy with other things, and if I had found out what was going on regarding the mass murders, it would simply have made me feel bad, and I could do very little to prevent it anyway.
Unsportsmanlike to kill children. Goering uses children as if they were syntactically equivalent to squirrels or crows. This is hardly a ringing endorsement of his capacity for empathy, nor did it help him to state that he didn't follow up on the rumors of mass killings, because it would simply have made me feel bad. Above all else, Goering was a chameleon with many personas. Nuremberg interrogator Joseph Meyer astutely observed, to the French, he was patronizing and scornful. To us, the Americans, he was the hearty, freebooting buccaneer he thought might appeal to presumably naive Americans suckered on Hollywood films. To the cold, skilled British, he was quiet and respectful, anxiously attempting a gentlemanliness he thought might appeal. With the Russians, Goering would wince and cringe slightly. He knew of no pose that would intrigue a Russian. He was frightened to death of every Russian he saw. Goering on trial. Goering saw himself as captain of the team and spokesman for all of the prisoners, and he believed that he deserved special treatment. In response to an order from Warden Andrus that the prisoners had to clean their own cells every Friday, Goering became so incensed that he developed arrhythmias. In this one instance, Warden Andrus gave in to Goering by assigning a prison employee to clean his cell, but Andrus loathed Goering, commenting that Goering began the extroverted, flamboyant play-acting that was to go on throughout the trial. He lounged with one fat arm spread out behind his neighbor, Hess, the other elbow hanging over the edge of the dock. Then he would loll forward, elbows on the barrier of the wooden dock in front of him, a grin spreading across his huge face. Goering turned his efforts toward organizing a consistent defense for all the defendants, and he fumed when other prisoners took an independent path or admitted responsibility.
Schweinhund und Verräter,
pig dog and traitor, he hissed at SS General Erich von dem Bach-Zelewski, who was testifying for the prosecution about anti-partisan activities on the Eastern Front. Not quite done, he continued,
dirty, bloody, treacherous swine, that filthy skunk, selling his soul to save his stinking neck.
He couldn't stop himself, and with jowls a-quiver he jeered at his fellow defendants, calling them chicken-hearted little boys. In contrast to the other war criminals on trial, Goering offered no apologies or excuses during his courtroom testimony. Instead, he dominated the court with his patient and condescending admission that nasty things happen during a war, and no one's hands are clean. Goering had no illusions about the eventual verdict. He was indignant that he would be hung rather than shot, but he also viewed his execution as a path to martyrdom.
I know I shall hang. I am ready, but I am determined to go down in German history as a great man. In 50 or 60 years there will be statues of Hermann Goering all over Germany, little statues maybe, but one in every German home.
Jackson versus Goering. In March 1946, Goering gave the performance of his lifetime, testifying extemporaneously for an entire week, giving his account of the war, his role in it, and its justification, and demonstrating a masterful recollection of details. It caught people by surprise. They mistook his corpulence for mediocrity. Janet Flanner, writing for The New Yorker, observed, "The Reichsmarshal made Machiavelli's prince look like a dull apologist. Goering was decidedly more amoral and funnier. Behind his fancy tailoring, his fat, and his medals, he had one of the best brains of a period in history when good brains were rare. It was the complicated narrative of a brain without a conscience." Goering and Justice Jackson were locked in a duel of wits. At first, Jackson appeared to be winning, and the other defendants watched from the box like a Greek chorus, cheering and moaning as the cross-examination continued. They were not necessarily rooting for Goering. There was too much jealousy for that. Rather, they enjoyed the blood sport of the testimony. Defendant Hjalmar Schacht noted with satisfaction, "The fat one is sure taking a beating so far." The first round went to Jackson, but it was a temporary victory that was quickly reversed. War correspondent Harold Burson commented succinctly, "Goering made mincemeat out of Jackson." Jackson had grown accustomed to the other defendants, whose response to questioning was typically something like, "Oh, those things were terrible, but I knew nothing about them and had no power to stop it." Goering did not apologize, and indeed counterattacked, saying, in essence, "Of course we did that. We were at war, stupid. You've done such things as well." Jackson, unprepared for Goering's bold stance, was flummoxed, stammering in rage. Goering picked apart everything Jackson asked and turned it on its head. Fluent in English, Goering complained that the consecutive translation was inaccurate and demanded time to be able to respond to questions. Jackson tried to cut Goering off and was incensed when the judges supported Goering's right to give long-winded replies. The excerpts that follow give a sense of Jackson's difficulties and his mounting frustration. Jackson: "And yet, because of the Führer system, as I understand you, you could give no warning to the German people. You could bring no pressure to prevent that step, and you could not even resign to protect your own place in history." Goering: "There are several questions at once. I should like to answer the first one." Jackson: "I repeat the question. Did Seyss-Inquart become Chancellor of Austria with an understanding that he would call in the German troops and surrender Austria to Germany, or did you lead him to believe that he could continue an independent Austria?" Goering: "Excuse me, but that is a number of questions which I cannot answer simply with yes or no. If you ask me, did Seyss-Inquart become Chancellor according to Hitler's wishes and yours? Yes. If you then ask me, did he become Chancellor with the understanding that he should send a telegram for troops to march in? I say no, because at the time of the Chancellorship, there was no question of his sending us a telegram. If you ask me thirdly, did he become Chancellor on the understanding that he would be able to maintain an independent Austria? Then I have to say again that the final turn of events was not clear in the Führer's mind on that evening." There were many interchanges like this, and most observers gave the match to Goering, who bragged to his lawyer, "Jackson is not up to me." When Goering completed his testimony, he savored his triumph. "Don't forget I had the best legal brains of England, America, Russia, and France arrayed against me with their whole legal machine, and there I was, alone." The Assessments of Kelly and Gilbert. Whereas Kelly was sardonic and tended to avoid jargon, Gilbert was judgmental, and his later writings tended to be doctrinaire. Both agreed that Goering was venal, corrupt, and brutal. Gilbert noted, "Goering tried to give the impression of a jovial realist who had played for big stakes and lost, and was taking it all like a good sport. He had abundant rationalizations for the conduct of the war, his alleged ignorance of the atrocities, the guilt of the Allies, and a ready humor which was always calculated to give the impression that such an amiable character could have meant no harm. He had a pathological egotism." But that was the extent of their consensus. Gilbert saw Goering as a monster and a contemptible bully with a cowardly core. In contrast, Kelly admired Goering for being the rogue that he was, and furthermore asserted that the world was filled with such people. There are undoubtedly certain individuals who would willingly climb over the corpses of one half of the people of the United States, if by doing so they could thereby be given control of the other half. To Gilbert, this admiration for a rogue was not just errant nonsense, it was an anathema. Goering and Kelly hit it off well, indeed. Some felt that Kelly was too close to Goering. Kelly encouraged Goering's storytelling, and Goering felt that in Kelly he had an appreciative audience who could do him an occasional favor. Kelly describes his interactions with Goering as follows. As a prisoner and as a patient, Goering was one of the easiest to get along with and to interview. Each day when I came to his cell on my rounds, he would jump up from his chair, greet me with a broad smile and outstretched hand. "Good morning, doctor. I am so glad you have come to see me. Please sit down, doctor. Sit here." Then he would ease his own great body. He still weighed about 200 pounds when the trial began, down beside me, ready to answer my questions. Goering asked Kelly's assistance in contacting his wife and daughter, and Kelly carried a letter to them from Goering. "Today I can send you a letter direct. Major Kelly, the doctor who is treating me and who has my fullest confidence, is bringing it to you. You can also talk to him freely. You can send me an answer through Major Kelly, and you will understand how I long for it." Goering was so grateful that he offered Kelly one of his enormous bejeweled rings, but Kelly declined. "Well, here is something just as good," Goering said, and gave Kelly an autographed photograph of himself. Deeply concerned about the well-being of his daughter Etta, Goering worried what would become of her if both he and his wife died. He turned to the one person he trusted, Kelly, and asked him to adopt Etta if she were orphaned. Kelly's response is unknown. However, from today's vantage point, we would stir uncomfortably, wondering about the boundary issues between psychiatrist and patient. Goering clearly liked Kelly, and even wept when Kelly left Nuremberg. Kelly described Goering as charming when he chose to be charming, highly intelligent, imaginative, and humorous, while also brutal and having a complete disregard of human life. Although Kelly was close to Goering, he still saw Goering's dark side. He was an individual who one moment could be the life of the party and a friend to all, and the next could without compunction order all his companions to their deaths. He continued, "Goering's personality is that of an aggressive, narcissistic individual who is dominated by his fixation on himself. He is filled with enthusiasm about everything he undertakes, but has little or no interests in the affairs of others." Given Goering's addiction, obesity, and uncertain cardiac status, Kelly worried that he might not survive the trial. When Goering surrendered, he weighed in at 280 pounds and had various cardiac symptoms. Kelly claimed that he had helped Goering lose weight by appealing to his narcissism, telling him that he would make a better appearance in court should he lose some weight. Kelly also took credit for curing Goering of his opiate addiction by gradually tapering the dose of pills and appealing to his narcissism as a way of coping with a drug withdrawal. Goering was very proud of his physical prowess and his ability to withstand pain. Consequently, it was simple to suggest to him that while weaker men like Ribbentrop, whom he loathed, would perhaps require doses of medicine should they ever be withdrawn from a drug habit, he, Goering, being strong and forceful, would require nothing. Goering agreed and cooperated wholeheartedly. Kelly reported that Goering's Rorschach showed a person of considerable intellectual endowment, highly imaginative, given to an expansive, aggressive fantasy life, with strong ambition and drive to quickly subjugate the world as he finds it to his own pattern of thinking. In another document, Kelly said that Goering's Rorschach demonstrates normal basic personality, but added that his thought content reveals marked egocentricity and powerful emotional drives. Once again, Kelly concluded, "This man is competent and demonstrates no evidence of psychopathology. He is able to face trial." Elsewhere, Kelly commented, "He is in excellent physical condition and is considerably sobered by the recent testimony, is still carrying the general feeling of keen spirit for the group. Goering faces his fate in a philosophical fashion, expects to hang and is no psychiatric problem. There is little expectancy that he will break at any point, and as the evidence piles up, he will probably harden his personality to face it. He will undoubtedly carry through without trouble." Gilbert seemed more aware of Goering's viciousness than Kelly, or possibly Goering revealed this side of himself to Gilbert rather than Kelly. Referring to a transcription of one of Goering's speeches in 1934, Gilbert quoted the record and offered up his own rather stilted interpretation. "Goering, I am not here to exercise justice, but to wipe out and exterminate." Gilbert,
If the frustrated masses had regressed to the aggressive, submissive modes of behavior of their authoritarian culture, clamoring for strong-arm leadership, Goering was not one to disappoint them. Gilbert's writings were sometimes harsh and doctrinaire, filled with labored and condemnatory jargon. Like the typical psychopath, Goering never outgrew the uninhibited action out of these infantile ego drives. In another instance, Gilbert primly commented on Goering's relationship with his wife, who was distressed by his blind loyalty to Hitler. When Gilbert mentioned this to Goering, he brushed it off, saying in essence that it wasn't a woman's affair to meddle in such things. Gilbert's interpretation staggers under the weight of his censure and verbiage. Goering's medieval egotistical sense of values is complete down to the chivalrous attitude toward women, which conceals its narcissistic purpose behind a facade of condescending protective indulgence, and allows no womanly humanitarian values to interfere with that purpose. Gilbert was at his best when he lingered near the prisoners, eavesdropping and summarizing their interchanges. One would have to be Machiavellian indeed to surpass Goering's view of war.
"Why, of course the people don't want war. Why should some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war when the best that he can get out of it is to come back to his farm in one piece? Naturally, the common people don't want war. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along. The people can always be brought to do the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them that they are being attacked, and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in any country."
Despite his irony and intellect, you could not miss Goering's streak of sheer nastiness. Because Gilbert often hovered nearby, in the lunchroom, in the prisoners' cells in the evening, or at the courtroom, we can hear some of these unscripted moments. In court one day, Defendant Schacht was trying to portray himself as anti-Nazi, and Jackson was just starting to make mincemeat out of him, when Gilbert overheard Goering whispering to Hess, "Put on your earphones. This is going to be good." Gilbert considered Goering an egotistical extrovert and adventurer, a cunning and cynical realist who regards power politics as a game of selfish interests, and history as a show in which the clever and the strong, like himself, play the hero's role. Gilbert also noted something that Kelly had failed to document. Goering was an excellent splitter and fomented quarrels left and right. He was maligning the psychologist to the psychiatrist, the Catholic chaplain to the Protestant chaplain, and vice versa, both chaplains to the psychologist and psychiatrist, and vice versa, while fawning on each in turn. When Gilbert asked Goering to complete the Rorschach, he wasn't aware that Kelly had already tested him. As Goering saw the cards emerging from Gilbert's briefcase, he commented, "Oh, those crazy cards again." Gilbert was humorlessly disappointed that Kelly had been there ahead of him, but conceded, "The two Rorschach records are substantially the same, except for some signs of increased depression and morbid anxiety on the retest." Kelly claimed that Goering's Rorschach showed considerable intellectual endowment. Gilbert disagreed, claiming that the Rorschach revealed the qualitative mediocrity of his intellect, superficial and pedestrian realism, rather than brilliantly creative intelligence. This interpretation may reflect Gilbert's bias, because elsewhere Gilbert reported that Goering scored in the gifted range on intelligence. Gilbert's most famous Rorschach observation stemmed from a small gesture Goering made while viewing one of the cards.
"He literally tries to brush off the blood spots on card 3 and figuratively gives the morbid and sadistic second response on that card the brush off in the inquiry. It seems to betray the basic consciousness of guilt and the need to escape it, in spite of the outward bravado. Lady Macbeth's nightmare was hardly more obvious in betraying her anxiety to rub out the damned spot. He was a coward who shirked his responsibilities when he could have done something about it."
A few days after being sentenced to death, Goering asked Gilbert what the Rorschach tests revealed, and Gilbert replied,
"Frankly, they showed that while you have an active, aggressive mind, you lack the guts to really face responsibility.
You betrayed yourself with a little gesture on the inkblot test by flicking at a red spot on one of the cards. You thought you could wipe away the blood with a little gesture. You've been doing the same thing all through the trial. You did the same thing during the war, too, drugging the atrocities out of your mind. You didn't have the courage to face it. You are a moral coward. This was quite an interpretation, but I think it reveals Gilbert's difficulties in navigating his various roles at the trial. Gilbert, no longer the interpreter nor the prison psychologist, could now become the avenger. Gilbert noted gleefully that Goering was offended by his comment to the extent that he filed a complaint about Gilbert with his defense counsel. It speaks volumes about how Gilbert viewed his role with the prisoners. In an interview with a reporter, Gilbert made quite clear his attitude about the war criminals. Hermann Goering's front of bravery is all baloney. They are all cowards, every one of them, including Goering. They are all trembling in their cells right now. The front they put up in court was all bravado. They don't find death as easy to take as it was to dish out. One senses that Gilbert is on firmer ground with his overall description of Goering, a description based not so much on the Rorschach record, but on Gilbert's prolonged observations. Goering is an aggressive psychopath with an insatiable lust for power, titles, wealth, food, and ostentatious display, ready to murder, steal, or stage frame-ups to gain his ends. The camouflage of the amiable extrovert and humorist. His behavior at the trial was a reproduction in miniature of the character he portrayed in history. Amiable showmanship on the courtroom stage, with a display of bravado, loyalty, innocence, and patriotism, while giving vent to his coarser qualities backstage. Gilbert sums up Goering as a ruthlessly aggressive personality camouflaged by disarming amiability when it suited his purpose. Years later, he described Goering elegantly and succinctly as an amiable psychopath. Goering's End. After Goering's sentencing, there were hints of trouble. Lieutenant Colonel William H. Dunn, one of the psychiatrists who had succeeded Kelly, continued his rounds on the prisoners as they awaited their execution. Goering, he warned, will face his sentence bolstered by his egocentricity, bravado, and showmanship. Goering will seize any opportunity to go out fighting. 1 hour before Goering was to be hanged, he quietly killed himself with cyanide. He had said all along that he would not let the Allies hang him, that such an end would be beneath his dignity. In his suicide note, Goering wrote, I would have allowed myself to be executed by a firing squad, but the German Reichsmarschall should not die on the gallows. Therefore, I choose the manner of death of the great Hannibal. I knew that I would be sentenced to death because I viewed the entire trial as a political stunt of the victors, but I expected that I would be granted the right to die like a soldier. Before God, my people, and my conscience, I consider myself not guilty of the crimes of which an enemy court has convicted me. In a letter to his wife, Goering added, My one and only sweetheart, after serious consideration and sincere prayer to the Lord, I have decided to take my own life, lest I be executed in so terrible a fashion by my enemies. My life came to an end when I bade you farewell for the last time. My last heartbeats are for our great and eternal love. A small pool of reporters was to observe the executions. Correspondent Kingsbury Smith broke the news that Goering had evaded execution. Hermann Goering did not lead the last Nazi parade today, the one to the gallows. He lay dead in his cell by his own hand, and Joachim von Ribbentrop took his place at the head of the march into eternity. Colonel Andrus had to announce the suicide to the world. When Kelly heard the news, he commented, His suicide, shrouded in mystery and emphasizing the impotency of the American guards, was a skillful, even brilliant finishing touch, completing the edifice for Germans to admire in time to come. Gilbert called it differently. Goering died as he had lived, a psychopath, trying to make a mockery of all human values and to distract attention from his guilt by a dramatic gesture. How Goering obtained the cyanide is still a mystery, although by the end of the war cyanide was everywhere in Germany and suicide rates were skyrocketing. When the Berlin Philharmonic performed Richard Wagner's opera Götterdämmerung, Twilight of the Gods,
in April 1945, Hitler Youth stood at the exits, handing out cyanide capsules to anyone who preferred to die rather than surrender to the Red Army at the gates. While the prisoners and their cells were searched repeatedly and contraband was confiscated, those searches were not as extensive in the rooms where prisoners' property was stored. Although visitors and lawyers were searched, they may not have been searched carefully by the dwindling numbers of soldiers who had limited training as jail guards. Some of the guards became attached to their wards, particularly when they were famous and charming, like Goering. At least two guards have emerged as the possible cyanide carriers. One guard, Herbert Lee Stivers, claimed that his German girlfriend asked him to carry medicine to Goering in his last days. Another suspect, prison guard Jack Tex Wheelis, was also regarded as being overly friendly with Goering and retrieved various items for him from the prison storage room. Even the OSS was suspected of aiding in Goering's suicide. They were grateful for his information on German resources and knew that it would be helpful in the looming Cold War struggle with Russia. Allowing Goering a more honorable death was an acceptable trade-off. Ned Putzel, aide to OSS Chief Donovan, claimed that he had given Goering the cyanide because Donovan secretly decided, with the agreement of the British contingent, to let him die by cyanide. Goering had been very cooperative with us, and he genuinely did seem deserving of some sort of mercy. He was glad to have it. It was better than being hanged. Last, Douglas Kelly himself came under suspicion, particularly after his own similar death years later. Many observers had noted his close relationship with Goering and wondered if he could have smuggled the cyanide into Goering. Decades later, it is unlikely we will find out who gave Goering the cyanide, but his suicide was a major body blow to Warden Andrus. His adversary had outwitted him, and the press was quick to assign blame. Time magazine seethed, "How could it happen?" It happened because the army had placed in charge of the prison a pompous, unimaginative officer who wasn't up to his job. Colonel Burton C. Andrus loved that job. Every morning, his plump little figure, looking like an inflated pouter pigeon, moved majestically into court. Years later, Andrus rebutted Time by saying, "My weight was 160 pounds, height 5 foot 10 inches, chest 44 inches, waist 36 inches. A plump pouter pigeon." He didn't bother to reply to the rest. But even on his deathbed in 1977, Andrus was haunted by Goering, calling out in confusion, "Goering's just committed suicide. I must inform the council." Chapter 7. Defendant Julius Streicher, Bad Man. In that initial hour of religious instruction, I realized for the first time in my life that the character of the Jew was abominable and detestable. Julius Streicher, August 3, 1945. Lieutenant Colonel Griffith Jones. "And do you think to call them bloodsuckers? A nation of bloodsuckers and extortioners? Do you think that's preaching hatred?" Streicher. "That is a statement, the expression of a conviction which can be proved on the basis of historical facts." Nuremberg Trial Transcript, April 29, 1946. Our goal was not to inform, but to egg on, to fire up, to urge on. The organ that we founded should in a sense act as a whip to wake the dilatory sleeper from his slumber and to drive him forward to restless action. Joseph Goebbels, 1938. On trial at Nuremberg, again. So far we have met remorseful Robert Ley, in many ways a futurist for workers' rights, and Hermann Goering, defiant and charismatic. Neither were stick-figure-thin demons, but very complicated amalgams of vision and malice. For sheer nastiness, unalloyed with any saving graces, we need to turn to Julius Streicher. It wasn't Streicher's first time in the Nuremberg courts. Over the years, he had been on trial many times for slander, corruption, sadism, and